nobody can.
And then we change the batting order, and then it's Matt C., and then if there's any time left, it'll be me. Could I?
I think there has to be time for you. Yes, the plan today is to try and draw together everything that we've been talking about this term and look a bit to the future with, you know, future surveys for primarily for Supernovae, but that can do other things. So my job is to tell you about the surveys and what you or what we expect them to do for finding supernovae and measuring
can
rates.
You hear Phil?
No.
No. Okay.
Maybe we just should.
You have to
hold
that.
So Phil, make it on the other side, and I'll move over to that side. Okay, we're arranging for you.
If the mic on one look at home, that on the other look at home.
All right, can you hear me if I talk like this?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So what I just said to the people in the room and you missed was that we're trying to finish up this seminar series with a session on future surveys. So things that are planned for the next few years that are being designed to look for supernovae, but you can do lots of other interesting things with. So I'll tell you a bit about the supernova searches and a bit more about the rates and estimation and what the status of all that is, and then tell you about the surveys, and Mansi will then tell you more in particular about one local survey, the PTF. I didn't know what it stood for, I had to look it up, but Mansi will explain. And then hopefully there'll be time for Lars to talk more about things you can find in future surveys that are more exciting than 1A supernovae. Okay, so supernova rates, and when I say supernova rates, I mean supernova 1A rates, because there's almost nothing in the literature about any other kind of supernova rates, because there isn't really enough data to say much, but you'll see little bits in the plots as we go. But for 1As, it seems that the brightest 1As occur preferentially in young stellar populations, and the lower luminosity ones appear in the older populations. So it seems that maybe there might be two types of 1A going on, ones that go off in old populations and supernovae 1A that go off in young populations. So this was the starting point for Mannucci's analysis in 2005 or before. And then Evan and Lars did some work on this well, extending to higher redshift. So just take you through that a little bit. So one of the big supernova surveys around at the moment is the CFHT Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope Supernova Legacy Survey. And here's a plot from Sullivan's paper showing along this axis you've got the stretch of the supernova and histograms of those divided up by galaxy type. And the idea is that you can associate small stretch 1As with old stellar populations, both in spirals and in elliptical galaxies. Here's a plot from Peter Garnovich from another big supernova survey that's going on at the moment, the Sloan survey. What he's plotting here is 1A supernova rate against a proxy for the star formation rate. So this is U minus Z color. So on the left-hand side you have the late-type galaxies, and on the right-hand side you have the early-type galaxies. And what you see is for the old populations in the early types, the supernova rate just is constant. It goes with the specific supernova rate is constant, so it's just proportional to stellar mass. But in the late type galaxies, you have this, as you get more and more towards the younger stars, you get higher specific supernova rate. So perhaps there's some proportionality with the star formation rate. All right, so all of this is motivation for the Mannucci and Scannapiccia and Bilston model. here are plots of the supernova rate as a function of galaxy type, and you see increasing towards later types for all types of supernovae. So this is their model. They have two terms in the supernova rate, one that's proportional to stellar mass and one that's proportional to star formation rate. And then the game is to find the values of these coefficients out the front. And there's various ways you can do that. Here's what Lars and Evan used for the star formation rate back in 2005. It's this Madao plot that you see many times. I'll show you a bit later, there's a more up-to-date version of this, but it looks much the same, peaking at around redshift 1 to 2. Okay, we've gone through all of this. Okay, so here was more proof of why we think the supernova rate depends on star formation rate. This is another way of cutting up the legacy survey data and plotting it. You've got supernova rate versus specific star formation rate, and you see this increase going this way, where they've divided the host galaxies into three different kinds. So elliptical or early types over here and late types over there. I knew there was a reason why I could get away with 25 slides, because a lot of them show exactly the same thing. Okay, so this is a plot for the evolution of the supernova rate from Sullivan's paper. The CFHT legacy survey point is this one here, the dark solid point. And then all these other points come from other people's measurements in different surveys. So a lot of the difficulty in this field is deciding whose survey to trust and whose survey not to trust. And different people fit to different data sets according to whether they think they're reliable or not. Anyway, this is when the legacy survey team did the fitting to presumably all these points, and they fit the two-component model. That's the A times stellar mass plus B times star formation rate. They get this solid curve here, where they fix the normalization to go through their own data point. And then underneath, you can see the contributions from the different populations. So what they call prompt are associated with the star formation rate term, and that's the young stellar populations where the supernovae are. And then there's this term here from the what they call delayed, which is the old stellar population as well. Anyway, the prediction from this model that Lars and Evan were working out is that the supernova rate keeps going to out to very high redshifts, out to 2 and 3 and beyond.
Are the ones up at the top illuminated by casting aspersions on the survey they come from?
Yeah. It seems that... It used to be that...
You've got an updated plot, though.
Yeah. It's sort of changed over years as people have fitted to first one, then another, but it seems that these points are less believed at the moment because they're kind of replaced by the legacy survey point, which is a sort of better defined sample and larger sample as well. Then there's the higher redshift point. This is coming from the GOODS survey with HST. The GOODS authors believe in it, and everyone else is a bit, well, we don't know, because there's only two gold, so to speak, supernovae in that point. So some people like that point, some people don't. Here's another way of plotting that from a different team with the legacy survey. Again, this is the high redshift HST point, and these are the Tomry and Barris points that are becoming replaced by the legacy survey. So there is supposed to be a paper coming out on supernova rates from the Sloan survey. It's almost ready to submit, and I persuaded them to give me a copy of it, but I'm not allowed to distribute it. So I wrote down on a post-it note where it is, and it's about, they have their mean redshift is about 0.1, and their point is about here. So no surprises. And they find that, well, they were only able to use 17 supernovae for their analysis, and that's not enough to say something about the division between the different types of galaxies. But that's 17 1A supernovae out of a total of about 450 for the whole survey. So we can expect the Sloan results to get an awful lot better in the next few years.
So what contingency are the supernovae?
Well, first they The 450 is the number that they've discovered in the images and photometrically typed. And then some fraction of those they'll get to follow up with spectroscopy. And then they, from that subset, they have to define a well-defined sort of complete sample. And that brings the numbers down even more. And what this point was just for the first season. So they probably had, I think they had 100 in the first season, 200 in the second, 150 in the third. So 20 out of 100 is maybe what they were able to do then. We could hope for maybe 30, 40% of 450 in the next couple of years.
So I mean, it was on a previous plot, but I can say it here. So the other interesting number to note is that the one thing that everybody agrees on, by everybody I mean Mannucci, CFHD Legacy, and Filipenko's group, is the rate in a very old population, which is this 1 per 300 years. So if you take, So if you take that number, right, then you multiply that by the K-light density, you get that blue point, that blue arrow.
Oh, right, yes, I remember you.
Right, and so what's interesting is that that's sitting at minus 4.7. So we'd be shocked if it was below that number, because that would violate all the other normalizations we've measured. And if it's above that number, that's telling you something about the mix. You measure the rate above that number, then we'd have to blame that on the star, the local star formation, at, you know, redshift zero. Right? As this figure sort of shows, that the delayed is most everything and the prompts very little. Right?
Yeah.
And so that's going to be a very helpful number. The zero, if we actually had a real number at zero redshift, that people would start to, which would start to narrow this down. I think what we're going to see is that once that number has a small error bar, if it ever gets a small error bar, my prediction is that what we're going to see is that the prompt has to go back down again. You know, it's going to look more like this plot, as opposed to the next one you showed, where prompt still really matters at redshift zero.
Right. This is good. I tend to assume that everything at redshift zero is not as interesting as things at redshift one. Because I spend all my time studying.
It's never too late to come back.
Yes. Back to where things are bright.
Yes.
Okay, so just one last analysis of this supernova rate to talk about. And I'll explain why I started worrying about this. These guys, Hopkins and Beacom, went to a lot of effort to make a very good star formation plot, a very good fit to all the data in the Madal plot. And then, for an encore, went on to try and predict the supernova rates using their new star formation history. And not happy with just a two-component model, they thought they'd throw in this parameter, which was what people were doing before Mannucci spotted the bimodality, which is to say that all 1As explode after some fixed time delay, and then try and explain the rates we're using that model. So Hopkins and Beacom have both. They have a term that goes like stellar mass, but also like the star formation, but this has a delay. And then they just fit those three parameters to all the data they can find, where all is all the data they believe in, which is different from other people's sets of data that they believe in. And what they find is that they get their best fit with this term disappearing and having the whole supernova rate tracking this number. And what that means is that you can fit the this high redshift point and some of these other things as well with a different shape. But the reason I'm particularly interested in this is because this model and the Mannucci et al. Two-component model make very different predictions out here, sort of redshift 2, 3. You can see that there's going to be, you know, orders of magnitude difference out there. And that's important for me because I'm interested in not only high redshift supernovae, but lens supernovae. So this is a plot of the number of supernovae, these red and blue curves of different types, 1As in red, type 2s, sorry, 1As in blue, type 2s in red, the number that you expect to see in a magnitude-limited survey per square degree per year. And the magnitude limit is 24.5 because this is an LSST plot. And so these are the total numbers of lens supernova you expect to see in the 10-year LSST survey. And these numbers, when you know this integral will change quite a bit if we're allowed to put lots more supernovae at high redshift. But you can see that in any case, for the type 1As, once you get above redshift 1, it helps to have a lens there because it's making the magnifying effect is making the supernovae much more observable. So this is perhaps a way of getting at the very high redshift end and measuring the rates at high redshift. This is what one might look like in the LSST images. It's quite cool.
The reason I'm sure I understand this plot, so to make it interesting, if you multiply this by the sky, right, I need to be above 10 to the minus 4 to be, right, to get one a year. 40,000.
Yeah, so the LSST survey is 10 years, so this is this is one per year here.
Okay.
10 per year, 100 per year. But we haven't thought at all about how to do the rate calculation when you have a lens in the way.
But is it lensed by anything in the way, or is it specifically galaxy clusters or something?
Well, effectively it's by anything, but in practice all the lensing, most of the lensing is done by massive elliptical galaxies. That's where all the lensing cross-section is. So if you work out the numbers just with elliptical galaxies, you get roughly the right number of total lensed supernovae.
So you think that is the only way to get higher redshift supernovae?
No. So, not happy with just the good data. Dan Mao's group in Israel started looking for other ways of finding high redshift supernovae and hit upon the idea of going back to the Subaru deep field, which I think is sort of 27th magnitude in R&I or something, and re-imaging that, I forget the time difference, of order a year or more or 2 years later, and looking for things that have appeared since the last epoch. So there's no light curves in this data set, but you can at least spot supernovae appearing next to galaxies. And then Poznanski spent his thesis working out how to do accurate, or as accurate as possible, photometric typing of these little point sources that have appeared. And you can, you know, divide into 1As, which have one template, and core collapse, which have typically the type 2P template, and try and figure out the colors. And this is a sort of preliminary plot from them that Dan showed when he was here at the program. So the interesting thing about this is that they're comparing the numbers in goods in pink with the numbers in the supernova with the Subaru deep field. And they're sort of comparable. It's not as though the Subaru deep field is turning up lots of the 1As that we're sort of expecting from this two-component model continuing to high redshift. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when this stops being preliminary and becomes a solid result. Are the supernovae there or not at redshift 1 to 2?
But if we look at your lensing plot, and if I say it's flat between 1 and 2 for the rate, right, then that curve that's going up, your dashed ones that are going up that stop at 1 and turn down are going to keep going up.
Yeah, so this was my initial guess at what might happen, but...
No, but why wouldn't it be that the peak is higher?
Why, they go this way?
Wouldn't it look like that?
Yeah.
Right?
I think what...
That turnover is because of the turnover of the rate. So you move the turnover to higher redshifts. So it seems to me that...
Well, there's also a...
I guess what I'm saying is that this in a positive light, right? The lensing might be the best way to get the 1A rate at redshift 2, because you'll forget otherwise,
yeah.
And the distinctions are going to be pretty severe.
If it's so true.
It's a good leverage. It's a good leverage.
Yeah. And if it's true that the rate does dive after redshift 1, then it might be the only way to see these high redshift things at all.
Sure.
But no, I think this, the inadequacy of this blue line means I should ask Masamune to recalculate with the two-component model.
Yeah.
And that would make ourselves feel a lot better within the LSST collaboration as well.
Sure.
As we wait for a telescope to be built.
Yeah, we got time.
Yeah.
So in the goods and the SDFEs, which is the furthest redshifts of the number? Or the 42 or something, is it?
Sorry, what's the question?
What is the furthest one?
Oh, 1.5 or a little bit more. I forget exactly. But I think they're between goods and the SDF, I don't think there's too much difference in the redshift distribution, although it's pretty uncertain for Subaru.
But SDF was that with the current camera on Subaru?
Yeah.
So it's not going to get much better other than, but that was only like 5 nights or something with Subaru.
It was 2 nights.
2 nights.
Yeah.
Okay. So for about to invest a few billion dollars, we might want to get 20 nights on Subaru.
Yeah.
To get the rate.
I guess they're applying for it.
I'm pretty sure Danny's still doing it.
Okay, so that was an update on the supernova rate. So now let's think a bit about the design of these surveys and what's coming up in the next few years to do improve the accuracy of these things. So the shape of the 1A light curve basically dictates the design of the survey in terms of cadence, and then according to what size telescope you've got, you figure out how long to spend exposing on each patch, and you end up with some set of parameters which we can compare in a table at the end. But in the meantime, we can start from looking at things that are going on right now. Yeah, so goods, because they're specifically looking for high redshift objects.
Sure.
They don't have to go for the local cadence optimally to discover things might be, I don't know, 10 or 20 days.
Redshift.
But at redshift 1 or above, you get to multiply that by 2 from the cosmological stretch, the time dilation effect. So you
right,
can
so
do...
I understand that. I just don't understand how you get a factor 15 between Sloan and...
Because these, I think it's that these two are, they're both detection and follow-up together. So you do a one rolling survey, you detect things, and then you get a light curve just from the same survey.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas these guys, it was more like the Subaru Deep Field. They did widely spaced imaging to look for new things, not trying to catch them before the peak or monitor them
actually,
after the peak. Just detect it and then follow it up elsewhere. I think.
Okay.
So two different strategies, yeah. Most of I think most of the future surveys are of this form rather than this one, I think. Okay, so I didn't have time to go through every single supernova survey, but picked out this one as a very local survey. This one is not too different from this, I think, or maybe these two are similar. These two are comparable in terms of the depth to which they go. So for the people who can't see me, that was Essence and SNLS being kind of comparable, Supernova Factory and SDSS, I think, being comparable, and then LOSS at the local end. Okay, so... The reason why I went to some effort to summarize the properties of all these surveys is so that we can look back at these slides and ask, as well as supernovae, can we do anything else with this data? That was sort of one motivation for it. So what's the LOSS survey? This is being done with the Kate telescope at LIC. They're not doing a survey of blank sky, but instead monitoring 13,000 nearby galaxies and doing it relatively shallow imaging in four bands when they can. The seeing's pretty poor for this telescope, and they have a range of cadences. I don't know what their scheduling algorithm is, but it works out that the cadence can vary between 2 and 12 days.
Nearer galaxies are faster cadence.
Why is that?
Just so that we can look for faster transients.
Okay. So this is not just supernovae, it's
they
other stuff as well.
I mean, they were the ones who found MVD-5OT, the luminous red nova.
Okay.
That's not fast, right?
Okay. So yeah, they do the typing from the light curves and the photometry in the same way that Sloan do. I had to convert their redshift plot from kilometers per second into redshift, and it turns out to be about 0.01. And then they follow up with... various UC telescopes. So far, they've found 566 supernovae, but they have been going for 10 years. And they do include some core collapse supernovae. So there's some data coming up from the LOST collaboration on the core collapse rates. But I don't think it's published yet. This was from another KITP talk from Wei Dong Li, I think.
It's important to say for nearby supernovae, nearby galaxies, they find about half.
Half of all discovered?
Yeah, half of all discovered. But the other half are by a group of 20, say, quote unquote amateurs.
Mm.
So that could be a cadence thing? Or?
Different galaxies, I think. I mean, again, it's really hard to know, right? You could never get a rate out of the 15 amateurs. I mean, just how would you know what they looked at? So the advantage here is there's a log. They know again.
Yeah. Some of the stuff they do with subtracting the host galaxies is pretty impressive, I thought. They've got some good software for subtracting off the static models. There's a large number of undergrads working on this at Berkeley. Okay, so moving out a bit in Redshift, the Sloan survey has been, this is Sloan 2, has for the last three autumns been doing a supernova survey, so 3 months between September and December. They just finished the last one. And they look at a strip of sky around the celestial equator. It's called Stripe 82, so you see that in the papers a lot. It was imaged a lot in Sloan 1 for calibration purposes, I think. And so they picked this out as being a good place to look for supernovae because they had a good... both a good static image, but also some history of, you know, long-term variability. So one of the first things they do is they, when they find something in the difference imaging, if it correlates with a known variable from the Sloan 1 survey, they throw it out. I'm in the process of trying to get that veto catalog to find the long-term variable things. But so they get down to 21.5 magnitudes in about a minute. And have better seeing than at LIC, but it's still not great, 1.2 arc seconds. This cadence is by design for the supernovae because they want these nice, well-sampled local light curves. And they they have enough objects discovered by enough candidate supernovae in the imaging that they have to put in a lot of effort into doing photometric typing. This is now done robotically. By looking at the colors and the light curves and so on. When they first started in the first season, they checked everything by eye. And it took a lot of manpower, but they fixed that now. And over the 3 years, they found about 450 type 1a supernovae. And the reason this number of core collapse supernovae is so small is because their selection of 1as is so good. They just don't bother with anything that's not a 1a supernova, if they can help it.
So slow down, though. So. I mean, they have core collapse in the sample. If they had a type 2P with a nice 100-day plateau, they'd have a nice 25 points at the same magnitude. That would be in there.
It's right? There in the data, but it's. I think it's those things are rejected fairly early on. And there's few enough people working on the data that it's not a priority.
No, but I mean, they would have a light curve, right?
Right, so
call anybody up
this number here is, I think, the these are spectroscopically confirmed. By accident, because they thought they were following up 1As, and they turned out to be something else.
Okay.
So the actual number of core collapse supernovae will be much larger. But all you have to go on is multicolor light curves.
No, I understand. So what you haven't seen is, I mean the other, you know, some of these core collapse rates, as you've discovered, are, I mean, we have very little.
Mm.
So if I ask about type 2Ps, I mean, it seems to me there's got to be an answer out of this survey, independent of whether anybody followed anything up.
Yeah,
right. There's it's a bright for 100 days.
It sort of almost feels like the second division of the Sloan team is working on that, trawling through the light curves and things. There's just not been anything out yet because even the second division have to work hard on doing the 1As. So, and by second division, I mean people whose job it is not to do.
Understood.
Just like,
you're not saying the B team. We understand.
No. Like the TA or whatever it is in the States. Okay. All right, so the ESSENCE survey, This is a Harvard and others working on this, and they're using the CTIO Blanco 4-meter telescope, where the imager is called Mosaic, and it's 0.6 degrees by 0.6 degree camera. They have 36 fields that they're repeatedly imaging. I forget how it goes. I think they have half the night every other night or something on this as part of an enormous proposal they put in. So they do the imaging in RNI, and consequently their photometric typing is not as good as Sloan, but they have the high cadence so they can do the light curve analysis. You can't see from their papers what the typical seeing at CTIO is, I think because it's bad, but they don't say anywhere. But this is important because one of the future surveys is going to rely on this telescope. So they started in 2002 and they're supposed to go till 2008 to get six seasons. Again, they're optimized for 1A, so they don't bother with following things up that don't look like 1As. And they have to get spectra only at late times because they need to follow more of the light curve before they're willing to bet their spectroscopic time on it. And so they've ended up with 100 supernovae from the first 3 years, and they compare this to the supernova legacy survey data, which was sort of running at about the same time. And again, they have a few tens of spectroscopically confirmed core collapse interlopers, but there'll be many more in the photometry. All right, so going further out in redshift, and this number is getting smaller and smaller because you have to go deeper instead of wider. So the legacy survey, or at least the supernova part of the CFHC legacy survey, is 4 1-square degree fields. There's a wide survey as well for doing weak lensing, but it has no or very little cadence. You might be able to do something with the transients in it, but I haven't thought about that fully. So they're doing five-band imaging down to much deeper in taking longer exposures down to 25.5 or so. The seeing is very good at CFHC. They put a lot of effort into getting the camera working well so they'd have the good image quality. They say 6-day average cadence. What they actually do is they observe for 2/3 of the month when it's dark and have 3-day cadence then, and then they have a break for 10 days. And then come back when it's dark again. So on average, it works out to be 6 days, but it's actually 3 to 4 when they're actually sampling. It's a 5-year survey finishing next year, and this depth gets you out to a mean redshift of about 0.6 or so. And interestingly, they make it clear that the depth you quote for the limiting magnitude of a single image is not what you end up with as being the depth in your supernova sample. And that's not always spelled out, but it's interesting to remember that when comparing the future surveys. They do a lot of spectroscopic follow-up, like everyone else, and have ended up with, or will end up with, 500 1As and the usual few tens of interlopers. All right, so Mansi is going to tell you about PTF, so I'm not. But instead, his Sky Mapper, which is a telescope I didn't know about, but I do now. It's specially built at Mount Stromlo in Australia. It's a new 1.35-meter telescope with a large camera installed on it to do all of the southern sky, 20,000 square degrees in the south, in 6 bands. This V band is a very narrow thing that sits between U and G, but probably important for photometric redshift or something. It's quite a shallow survey, 19th or something, and the seeing histogram at Mount Stromlo isn't really like anything I've seen before. It has a tail below 1.7, which they call good seeing, and then it's sort of flat above that, and it didn't have an upper limit on the plot. So I think a lot of the time you get quite poor images from Mount Stromlo, but they have a strategy to, you know, for when they use the good seeing, when they don't use the good seeing, and it all works out.
The median is supposed to be 1.3, I think.
Maybe I was looking at a cumulative distribution. Okay, it's not clear from anywhere how long they're going to run this thing for. I guess it depends on funding and results. But they were supposed to get first light this August, but there's no news at all on the website, so I don't know what's happening with SkyMapper at the moment. Maybe some of you do. All quiet in Australia. They expect to get 200 supernovae, 1A supernovae per year in this sort of relatively local redshift range. But I think, I don't know if I actually saw this phrase somewhere in the, but they seem to be suggesting that the most interesting thing they'll do is to find new and exciting objects rather than large numbers of well-measured boring 1As. I just realized I don't have a slide for PanSTARRS, which is odd because I have lots of notes about it. But I can tell you about PanSTARRS one, maybe.
I was just realizing how close SkyMapper is to BTF.
Yeah, you could cover the whole sky between you.
No. In terms of this, I mean, it's almost the same A omega, right?
Yeah.
48 inches.
And 7.8.
And 7.8.
Oh.
Silence?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm about to explain, I'm ashamed of not making a PS1 slide. PS1 stands for PanSTARRS 1, which is the prototype telescope for the PanSTARRS system. So this is based in Hawaii and the PS4, the sort of main system, will be four 1-point-something meter telescopes taped together on the same table so they all point to the same patch of sky. So you build up your collecting area that way. But the prototype telescope called PS1 is on a different island in Hawaii from where PS4 will be and has been built and is being tested at the moment. So it has a large format imaging camera, I think 7 square degrees or something. I forget the exact numbers. But large enough such that it has a sort of pretty competitive 8-ondu. Their plan is to do a 30,000 square degree shallow static survey. So they can do 30,000 because they're in Hawaii at the equator where you can see more of the sky. But also to do some deep fields to do supernova surveys. And I think the current plan is to maybe do 150 square degrees in 5 filters where each epoch is maybe 24th magnitude or something. I think it's half an hour exposure, something like that. The current status of PanSTARRS 1 is that it's being, I guess you call it commissioned, but it's actually being aligned. They're getting the primary and the secondary mirror and then the tertiary mirror and all the optical elements stuck to the camera all aligned so that the image quality is seeing limited or atmospheric seeing limited is not easy in such a fast optical system. So they're iterating on the alignment at the moment. We can expect to see some high quality images late next year, I think.
Plus, they have a transient search. I mean, I know they focus on really fast rays, but they also have a transient search component.
Yeah.
Not just a static search.
I've got some of the numbers on the medium deep survey. I can pull those up.
I think that, well, I think it's not clear what their initial priority is.
I mean they're asteroids.
I mean, that's what the Air Force funded them to do, but it's not necessarily what the scientists are keenest to do. So they might argue that before making a fast asteroid searcher, maybe it's best to focus on a few fields and, you know, hammer on them and by chance discover lots of supernovae. Also, the weak lensing people are kind of keen to push on the image quality. One interesting thing that will happen in the next year is where will they draw the line in the alignment and in getting the image quality good, because you can do asteroids a lot more easily than you can do weak lensing. So at some point you have to stop fiddling with the system and start observing. And at that point the science, you know, priorities will get readjusted, I guess. I mean, at one point there was a plan to do a fast wide field asteroid survey, many epochs, but using a wide filter to build up the Etendue. But that seems to have gone away. I think now they're focusing on the multi-filter imaging. Okay, so the next thing after PanSTARRS is it's a project called the Dark Energy Survey, which is selling itself as doing four different cosmological projects all in one go. And to do that, it plans to look at 5,000 square degrees that overlaps with the SPT, the South Pole Telescope, which is doing a survey for clusters in the Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effect. And the plan there is to get photometric ridges for these clusters. So that's the main thing this system will do. But there's also a plan to spend some of the time on 9 square degrees. That's three fields with a new large camera on the same CTIO telescope that the ESSENCE survey was done on, and do repeated sort of 4 to 6 day cadence observations looking for supernovae. And the image quality seems to depend a lot on how well they can build the camera, which is currently under construction various places around the world. Last time I talked to Paul Schechter about this, he seemed pretty optimistic that everything was solved and that the image quality was good. And he describes himself as a seeing junkie, so maybe we can believe that. So they're scheduled for first light in the autumn 2010. And
does that mean that they've understood what the cause of bad seeing? I mean, so Paul's convinced he knows what the problem was.
Yeah, I think so.
And it was?
The proposal has been along the lines of, you know, we know that the CTIO telescope has problems and we know the image quality is bad, but we understand why. So we're going to strip it down, build a new camera, fix the optics, and then everything will be fine.
Well, but you haven't told me what the source of bad seeing is.
I don't know exactly what it is, but they know what it is. Yeah, I think it's distortion from somewhere, but I can't tell you which mirror or...
Okay.
And what would be the depth here?
I don't know.
Four meters, right?
Yeah, I'm guessing it would be similar to CFHT. So when I wave my hands at the supernovae numbers in the table, I was saying, oh, it'll be a bit like the supernova survey with the CFHT. So they're aware about how difficult it is to follow things up spectroscopically and are expecting to be able to follow up 500 supernovae. So,
are they taking over the Blanco telescope when they do this?
I think they get a third of the time per year for 5 years. So.
Yeah. So their 1A ray looks like the CFHT ray.
Yeah. And my impression is that there's a number of things that the DES is slated to do that won't be all that competitive by 2010.
Correct.
Except for the follow-up for the SZ cluster search, which was why they started doing this in the first place, but then added these extra dark energy components, I think, to sort of bulk up the proposal. Okay, and then beyond dark energy survey, and possibly at the same time as PanSTARRS 4 or something, we have LSST, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. So I was just at Slack the last 4 days finding out what the status of LSST is. So here's the latest. The main thing I learned were these two things here, which the first light is supposed to be May or June 2015, where first light means first photons through the telescope and onto the focal plane. The integration of the cameras is then expected to take another 6 months, so these 2 years here is when the commissioning is expected to happen. And the party line is that commissioning is kind of the same as surveying. So there'll be a lot of interesting science to be done in the first 2 years. So the basic plan with LSST is to do 20,000 square degrees with a custom-built 8-meter telescope with a 10 square degree camera. And the reason it's 6.4 meters effective area is because there's a big hole in the middle of the primary, which is where the tertiary sits. Secondary is up here, and then the tertiary reflects light up into the camera, which is mounted here and is the size of a small car. And the whole thing slews around within 2 seconds or something to the next field, takes 30 seconds worth of data, and then slews again. So this is going to be an impressive engineering feat. The imaging program is five filters G-R-I-Z-Y. The seeing at the site, which has been selected to be Serapachon, I think it's where Gemini is, Gemini South is 0.7 arc seconds. And the thing it's fun to think about for me at least is in the making static images from the best 10% of the images. But obviously that's no good for transients. The average cadence is 4 days. You hear people saying, oh, it images the whole sky in 4 days, every 4 days. Actually, that's true as long as you don't mind which filter your data are in. If you want to wait for an I-band image, then it's on average 20 days. And these numbers are from an old slide.
Strangely similar.
Yeah. Okay.
Something's
Ignore this. This is taken from the science requirements document. I colored it in to make it more exciting. And in it, there are some very small numbers. Yeah. This is, I hope, you know, if you're interested, you can go and look at this talk and see what the detailed numbers are for the different surveys. So this column here is what survey requires this information. And you see weak lensing, deep supernovae, all these different things. But in practice, I think what will happen is that the same giant 4-day universal cadence survey will be used for all the different projects. It's just when you get to this kind of design and this kind of throughput, it doesn't make any sense to do anything else than a universal cadence. All right. So final slide. This is a summary of a few current surveys and a few future ones where we've tried to fill in the numbers as best we can, but have had to guess many of them. So believe numbers that have decimal points in them, and the rest are sort of hand-waving. So this gap here is to be filled in by Mansi.
1,400.
Maybe you should tell us more about that.
Okay. So maybe you can ask Robert. The thing we missed on this was ROTC.
Could you ask that again? I couldn't quite hear.
He says the thing we missed on this table is ROTC. Where does ROTC fit in?
Every night, maybe 1 to 3 days for weather and when the night is short.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing is about 10 arc seconds.
What was it?
10 arc seconds, did you say?
Well, I have about 3 arc second pixels, so the seeing is actually dictated by the optics, so it works out to maybe 8 arc seconds, something like that.
Okay.
And we find something like 15 1/8 per year.
And cool. The typical redshift?
But weighted towards the luminous one. Well, sorry.
What? Huh?
Robert. It's
yeah.
Right. We're gonna install this on all four. So the.
Okay. Yeah. I was talking about TSS. So if you multiply that by 3, you can get what you can do with an entire night on one ROTC telescope, and then you can either scale that up by 4, or you can repeat fields and do a higher cadence.
Mm. Which do you think is more interesting?
I'd probably take the 2 telescopes in the northern hemisphere and have them do the same fields, and the same with the 2 in the southern hemisphere. So kind of double the rate and double the cadence.
And when you say 15 per year, is that if you're doing this full time, you would get 15 per year?
No, that's for a third of the time.
Okay, because that's the other number.
Get 45, 50 a year.
Okay, because that's sort of the number.
Sampling every day, you can easily sample a larger area and get a lot more.
Yeah, that part we understand. It's really a question of what's your rate of discovery?
So going forward, it should be something. I think 50 is optimistic, but 40 is.
Okay.
For one telescope, and then in 6 months we'll have it on 2 telescopes, and that should double it, because that second one will be in the south.
So do you guys have? Is there a number? I mean, it would be good. I think it would be good to try to get that in here because it's the only data point we've got at a lower magnitude. the large angle. So when we talk about PTF and we struggle with what's the zero redshift 1A rate, you know, it helps to have a few different places to bracket expectations, right? Is there a way to get some of those numbers? I mean, I'm speaking loud. I'm not sure if Robert is hearing me.
I can't quite make out if there's a question for me.
Okay. So the question is, Robert, it would be good to have those numbers. And, you know, maybe Eli has them. Maybe you, I presume you have them. So we can put it on this table. Yes?
Yeah, I have those numbers.
Yeah. But also, again, for the rate, it's the number that sort of matters is if you have the telescope full time, what's your discovery rate, right? Not that you only got it half the time, and so the numbers are smaller.
Okay.
Because I think we're trying to understand what are the expectations for some of the future surveys going forward, but there's nothing like an actual real data point based on what's actually happened. Okay.
Caltech. Robert?
Yeah, Mom.
Who else is at Caltech who I can call on?
They can talk.
Sorry? Who else is there?
Iran and Alan.
Oh, okay. Cool. So
they can talk.
Sorry about that. Okay, so I want to tell you guys about two surveys. One that just started this year, and is like the first chapter of my thesis, which is with the Palomar 60-inch telescope, which is this little telescope here, and the other is with the Palomar 48-inch telescope. And so PTF stands for the Palomar Transient Factory. That's with this 48-inch telescope. So. Just to remind everybody of the many things we've been discussing in the seminar, this is one way to represent the phase space of transients. So you have the novae at an absolute magnitude of -9 on a range of timescales. Sorry, this is in days. And you have the supernovae, which are right here, and they are -17 or brighter. And on the supernova day, I told you about a fainter one, which is at around -16. And you have a whole range of subluminous supernovae between -16 and -17 in absolute magnitude. And Arnie told you about luminous red novae, which lie around -13. That's this class here. On another day, we discussed core collapse supernovae. So these are the low luminosity core collapse supernovae. And LBVs are much longer timescales, but about this absolute magnitude here. So the first thing that jumps out at you when you look at this plot is that there's a lot of empty phase space that could be explored, right? And the question is, where in this phase space do the current surveys lie? And how best can we design future surveys to really understand the physics behind cosmic catastrophic explosions? So thanks to Iran, Offer. Here's just where our different surveys lie and how many galaxies per year do they sample? So SDSS-2, at the brightest end, has sampled something like 10 to the 7 L-star galaxies per year. If you go a little bit fainter, then it's 10 to the 5, 10 to the 4, 10 to the... that's the supernova factory, again on the Palomar 48-inch telescope. KATE, which is the Berkeley survey that Phil described, is about 1,000 L-star galaxies at this level. 13,000 is... Yeah, I mean, this is all order of magnitude. And if you go a little bit fainter, you can, it's for about 100 galaxies, they probe this magnitude range. And M85OT was actually discovered by them. Then if you go to the short time scales, you have the deep lens survey, which surveyed 3,000 galaxies. Interesting, there's a paper, again, by Sri and Arnie, on some interesting fast transients in the deep lens survey, which actually just turned out to be M-dwarf flares. And now I'd like to tell you a little bit more about the P60 survey, which is probing this phase space, but only with about 60 galaxies. So here is a plot of the sample of galaxies that we are looking at with P60. So essentially pick the nearest, most beautiful galaxies. These are all the galaxies that are within 10 megaparsec and with an absolute B magnitude of minus 18 or brighter. And since that gives you only a small number of galaxies, you can get a few more. And we pick the brightest galaxies, which are an absolute magnitude of minus 21 or brighter. And on this plot, basically, is a spatial distribution of these galaxies. So the circle here is, the bigger the circle, the closer the galaxy is to you. And the lighter the point, the brighter it is. So the whole idea behind this survey is to just use a 16 telescope, take images at every with a cadence of a few hours to daily, so really, really high cadence, and go deeper than other surveys in this region. So the other survey, the other big survey which looks at these nearest galaxies is the KATE survey. And that goes to about a limiting magnitude of 18 or 19. So what we want to do is we want to probe two more magnitudes in absolute magnitude to really search the phase space a little bit more thoroughly. So let's think, since the previous diagram was in terms of absolute magnitude, let's just convert what a depth of 21 means. So depth of 21 is about an absolute magnitude of minus 9 at 10 megaparsec. And you can scale that to 20 and 5 and 1. then the important thing is, again, just real-time reduction and identifying these transients and following them up. So far, we've just found, we just started a few months ago, and so far we found one LBV candidate in NGC 925. Three novae, which were already found by people who have bigger field of view in M31, and a flare star. Okay, so let's think a little bit more carefully about this question about if you want to look at faint transients, is it better to sample the whole sky, or is it better to focus on nearest galaxies? So let's just look at these numbers in a different way. So if this is my sample of 60 galaxies, and this is the B-band luminosity, and this is basically the depth to which that galaxy can be surveyed. So I've just taken 21 minus the distance modulus to that galaxy, and I get an absolute magnitude depth. So basically, if the galaxy is here, I can find everything minus 10 or brighter. If the galaxy is here, I can find everything minus 7 or brighter. So now if you take all of this, all the luminosity that you have in these 60 galaxies, and you just add them up in bins to get the total luminosity at that distance, you get this solid line histogram here. And if you take what is the known total luminosity density as a function of distance in this really, really local universe, this is just 10. This is just a plot that goes up to 20 megaparsec. So it barely includes Virgo. So you get this dotted line. And clearly, that this is for all. This is basically taking the mean K-band luminosity density into mass and multiplying that by 4/3 pi r cube. So clearly, you find that you can in the nearby universe, you can sample a significant fraction of the total luminosity density just by focusing on a few nearby galaxies. Okay.
You made that plot quick.
Yeah, this was this just an hour before the meeting. So, okay. So there's more to the universe than just the nearby galaxies, right? There's also these beautiful clusters. So the most prominent ones are Virgo, which is at 16 megaparsec right there. Then there's M31. This is on galactic, so it's slightly off. Perseus is up there. Okay. So you have Virgo, Coma. Coma is right on the top near Virgo. And Perseus. So the first way to probe the phase space is to look at the nearest galaxies. Just focus on 20 megaparsec. Then you want to look a little bit further and sample a larger volume so you can get a higher rate. So the sampling the larger volume and still going deep enough to look at things brighter than novae but fainter than supernovae, you need something with a larger field of view and more depth. So one of the experiments that surveys that will be doing this is the Palomar Transient Factory. So this is a collaboration between Caltech, LBL, LCOGT, Columbia, the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and IPAC. So this will be using the Palomar 48-inch telescope and the CFH-12K camera. This is the camera that was on CFHD before the current one. This gives you a field of view of 7.7 square degrees at a pixel scale of about 1 arcsecond per pixel. And the depth in a single exposure of 60 seconds with this camera and this telescope would be 21. And the filters, we would be doing just a single band survey at most times and switching between G and R depending on the moon phase. So if the moon is bright, you go to R band because sky is too bright, and moon is dark, G band. And again, the whole idea of this experiment, 100% of this or 80% of this time is on the telescope is to look for transients in real time, classify them, and follow them up with instruments elsewhere with both photometrically as well as spectroscopically. So the real-time transient identification part is being led by Robert Quimby. The classification is being led by Josh Bloom at Berkeley, and follow-up is pretty much everyone. Like the 16 telescope would be would dedicate a huge fraction of its time in just following up transients that are found with PTF near real-time. So as soon as you find something, you get multi-band information, multi-band color information, and for the best one, spectroscopy. Okay, so there are three major experiments that are currently planned for PTF. The first is a five-day cadence experiment, which would survey 7,000 square degrees. And the primary motivation here is to look for supernovae. And these would be supernovae of both type 1A and core collapse. And the number that that Phil was talking about. So if you look at, this is a plot by Sharon, from Israel, and if you just look at the limiting magnitude, and the number here would be 0.2 per square degree, and multiply that by 7,000, you get 1,400 supernovae per year. And there are other things also that drive the five-day cadence experiment, things like luminous red novae, subluminous 1As, extragalactic novae, RLIRA, anything. So basically, the supernovae fields would be including the nearby galaxy and nearby galaxy cluster fields, so that we can look for some of these other interesting emerging classes of transients. This survey would be only in one filter. The whole Earth will only look in R band, and the choice of fields for this would be at high galactic latitude, so you're not contaminated by things that are just in our own galaxy. And The plan is to get three 60-second images, two consecutive and one after 40 minutes. This is just a way to reject asteroids, and that's all I mean, things that move. Okay, the second survey that is planned is during bright time, when the moon is bright, is a narrowband survey. So this would be three nights around full moon, so before and after full moon. And there are three possible filters we could use for this. So with one filter in about 12 months, using three nights, we can get 3π. And the three filters that we're considering for this survey are the H-alpha filter, the O3 filter, and the Z-band filter. So the motivation for the Z-band is high redshift quasars, which drop out in Z-band. The motivation for H-alpha is galactic structure. Then O3 is planetary nebulae, things like that. And the third experiment on PTF is the dynamic cadence experiment. So this is really to probe things on 1 minute to 1 day timescales. So the science driver for this is really to search for new classes of transients. And the dynamic cadence experiment in the first 6 months is going to look something like this. So in the first 2 months, which would also be the commissioning phase, we would be continuously observing five fields. And rotate these five fields every week. So if you continuously observe five fields, you would be getting 38 square degrees at a cadence of 7.5 minutes. During the commissioning phase, this will be the only experiment on the telescope, so you can get a continuous baseline of fast cadence observations. And the second experiment that would the second experiment during for dynamic cadence would be nearby galaxies. So this would be the very, very nearby galaxies like M31, M33, so that's a list. And the nearest galaxy clusters like Virgo, Coma, and Perseus. So the same question needs to be asked is that if you want to look for fainter things, then just by picking few of the biggest, nearest galaxy clusters, can you probe a substantial fraction of the total volume in terms of mass or luminosity? And the third experiment would be a 300 square degree experiment. This would be at a cadence of 2 hours. Every 2 hours, you'd be coming back to that field. And this would involve 40 fields, just divided by 17. Yeah, that's pretty much all that I had to say. And I mean, this is more a forum to think of ideas or experiments that would be most optimally explore the space space. And just what would you like to do with a telescope or an experiment like this?
So, Monty, can you show us from the 60-inch?
Mm-hmm.
You can go back to that plot because I hadn't seen it before. Now that you've got it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So this is M31 and M33. That's why it doesn't.
So at -8 and above, mm-hmm. -8 and fainter. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That you've got easily a few by 10 to the 11 solar masses. Probably. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm just summing.
This is 10 to 11.
Right.
Yeah.
So at -8 and fainter, you've got around 10 to 11 solar masses of stuff. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So how does this convert to the white dwarf rate?
Well, no, I was just saying if you so those galaxies that are sitting between -6 and -8,
mm-hmm.
you should be finding novae in those at a pretty nice rate. So at 10 to 11, there's 20 classical novae per year. So you've got roughly, you should be finding 20 classical novae per year in that bin between -6 and -8. Have you seen any there?
No novae candidates so far.
Is your seeing such that you'd find it in the light?
Yeah, I mean the.
So those at that distance scale, right? You see what I'm asking, which is what's the surface brightness of those galaxies? Would you actually be able to see the classical novae? So this is how deep you go, but you have to then find it in the surface brightness.
Yeah, so I guess you lose about a magnitude because you're going to be sitting on top of a galaxy which has high surface brightness.
Right.
So from 21 you would go to 20, so you could shift these numbers by, I mean, I don't think you could shift these numbers by more than 2 magnitudes, right? I mean,
well,
I think it would be magnitude.
I don't know, it depends on your seeing and things like
so
that.
So the mean seeing is about maybe 1.5 arc seconds, and it ranges from maybe 1 to 2 to 3.
I guess the other way to ask the question, for those galaxies that are, let's say, at the -6, mm-hmm. there's a bunch there that are between mm-hmm. -7 and -6. Do mm-hmm. you see globular clusters in those galaxies in the data sets you have? Because that's the brightness of a globular cluster. So that would be the.
I haven't checked.
I think that would help you to know whether mm-hmm. your depth is actually good enough, because those probably have known globular cluster catalogs, and you can see if you can actually find them in your data set. Because that's a typical one, is that right?
Waiting for Eric to correct me.
Yeah. Is that right?
Or it should be SPF data on the globulars.
Yeah. Right.
SPF, what does that stand for?
The surface brightness fluctuation. They make maps of the okay. surface brightness, and they have to take out the point sources. So they'll have Tonry or someone else will have good maps of the globular clusters for most of the nearby galaxies.
Okay. So yeah, I can check that. Because they're about as bright, right? The Nova would be about as bright.
Where's the peak?
-7.5.
Yep, but we just started this year, so stay tuned for more announcements from me.
Have you taken over the V60?
No, this is basically when V60 is not chasing GRBs or other interesting transients, following up other interesting transients, or doing Caltech projects, so it's about 50 to 60% of the time. So it's like the default program, and then there's lots of other things that are happening. So more PTF experiment.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about a few things. But other questions from Monty or other comments? Or? So let me understand, is this, I guess I don't have a sense for how you generated your sample for the P60.
This is just a Tali 2008 in prep catalog. So he sent me a catalog where he's revised his distance estimates for a lot of, for I think 20,000 of the closest galaxies.
Okay.
And these have really nice distance moduli, and I just believe those because there's a lot of arguments about what the distance of these galaxies are. So I just take that catalog and I put two cuts. The first is I take everything brighter than absolute B magnitude of minus 18 and closer than 10 megaparsec. And then I take everything that's brighter than minus 21, irrespective of its distance. So that way I get the brightest Virgo. Just the brightest ones in Virgo.
And those two are M31 and M33 and
M4. If you were in the southern hemisphere, you would have LMC somewhere too. But
so are you going deeper, though, in M31 than the NOVI surveys?
Yes. So I find NOVI, but I have also very small field of view.
Right.
So I have only 30 nakpuna field of view, but I find NOVI, like NOVI keep popping up on my webpage even like days after, like when they've already faded to like, then they've already faded to like 20 or something like that. I still see them as transient candidates. I've already found NOVI. So
you would get
many days after, probably, I think one of them was like more than week, 10, 15 days, something like that after.
So you're picking them up earlier then, if you get lucky and they're in your field of view.
True. I have about 6 pointings for M31, which is not enough, but
I already forgot. What was the cadence again?
Two hours is the best, and near daily. 2 hours near daily. So it depends on how long the galaxy is visible and what else is going on in the queue.
So do you have one day sample NOVI light curves?
For the M31? Yeah.
Yeah.
For 3 of them this year, but that's, I think, 29 or something total.
It was like 20 a year or something.
This year, I think it's 27 or 29 or something like that.
Do those exist in literature?
What?
The light curves that are that sample?
Those? Have you looked at Chipparf's thesis work from 1955?
No.
So there's a great plot that was in Alan Shafter's review article, I think, of the last time there was some detailed work done for the light curves, which was Chipparf in 1950-something.
Oh, okay.
You
know, there's a bright nova which had an absolute magnitude of minus 10 recently that Robert Quimby discovered in ROTC, and that one, I think Alan knows about that light curve,
yeah,
because we've been talking to him, and so he knows about a more well-sampled light curve, at least for that one.
What's the data rate like? Is it manageable, keeping up with all the
things? Grad students don't sleep, so it's okay. No, but this is about a couple of GB a night, 2 GB per night.
And there's a, you have the Python to...
Yeah, so within 10 minutes of the telescope observing the data, the telescope observes a galaxy image. There's an automatic routine. It's a robotic telescope. There's an automatic routine that does a flat fielding, bias subtraction, all that stuff, and then puts a WCS. It puts a coordinate system on that. Then the data gets transferred to Caltech. And at Caltech, we have an image subtraction pipeline. So we take a reference image. We subtract the current image. We flag transient candidates in that, and we update a web page. And that web page gets updated within 10 minutes of the image being taken on the telescope. So, yeah, so if I'm awake at night and I see something interesting, I could potentially follow it up. so we do plan. I mean, once I have my algorithm of throwing out the junk, and so right now I still scan the web pages by eye. So there are some like image subtraction artifacts and things that need to be dealt with. So, but once the scanning and identification of transients can also be automated, then in the near future, hopefully, we'll be able to pick the most interesting transients and automatically trigger multiband follow-up or any other kind of follow-up that would be interesting for a fast transient. So we're getting there. So.
And how long are you going to do this?
Until PTF comes online. So PTF should come online in October of 2008. And starting then, basically, most of the P60 time will be just follow-up of PTF discoveries. But PTF would be taking over this, essentially, right? Because the dynamic cadence fields all include the nearest galaxies and the nearest galaxy clusters. So the discoveries would be with that. So this is a dry run in that it's also a single-band experiment. It's just G-band. It's not multi-bands, just so you can do the most number of galaxies with the highest cadence. So that's one of the trade-offs. And so you asking something, sir?
The data rate is going to go up by an enormous factor with the CFH12K camera.
That's true. I think it's supposed to be 50 GB. Iran, what is the number? 50 GB per night?
Yes, yeah.
What is the data rate with PTF, like 50 GB per night or something?
Data rate, terabytes per night.
It's huge. I don't remember the number. What is it?
I'm thinking.
Oh, okay.
He's calculating. Bits.
Yeah, I think it's 50 GB.
Okay, great.
When we think about it,
you should tell him we can't hear him. Pretending to communicate with us, it's not working.
Okay, so I want to briefly talk about a few things sort of motivated by PTF that might or might not work with PTF. Oops, I should get it mic'd up. And then if there's time, I'll do something with the black.
Half a terabyte tonight.
How many terabytes tonight?
44.
So let's say 400 gigabytes tonight. Okay, so what I want to talk about are a few science thoughts at minus 17 and fainter. Okay, so this is trying to summarize some of the stuff we've done here, but also start to highlight some of these issues. And Monsi and I have been talking this morning. I think there's some different ways of trying to at least know what the reach of your survey is for some of these things that we've been talking about, but we might not know actually what to expect. So I'm going to briefly talk about the subluminous, a little bit on the 0.1As, but not too much because you've all heard the story. And a little bit on this, and then hopefully some issues that are going to address these cadence questions. Okay? So first off, the subluminous, just to put things in perspective, are this class that in the Phillips relation are these objects that are drawn here and as these solid circles. So they're typically much fainter. Here's B, V, and I. They are more or less on a generous extension of the Phillips relation. Namely, you let them define how to draw the Phillips relation further out. Okay? They are basically tracking quite nicely the old stellar population. They're most prevalent in ellipticals and S0s, and when you see them in spirals, they're typically in the halo. You can basically convince yourself of that. Though, again, we'll have to see with the Sloan, who should have a lot of these. Sloan, you know, should have tremendous numbers of these subluminous 1As. You know, they're probably have the best data set right now for these, but I've seen nothing. And maybe you've heard of what's going on, but they should have a lot of these in Sloan. So this just shows, and so they're also sometimes, just so you know, called 1A-PEC for peculiar. You can again see that this is from the Kate survey that they're in ellipticals much more preferentially than spirals. And again, if you go through and check a lot of these, you can convince yourself they're probably just from the old population that should be in a spiral. Okay? So they are unusual. They are faint, and they rapidly rise and fall. And they're in an old population. So again, it would be good to try to nail these down. So I just want to bring up one potential science goal that one could imagine as a test case of how to design a survey to go after something. It might be a bad idea to do this scientifically, but I think it's helpful to actually have something you can get your hands on. So this is just showing some of the light curves. So here's 1999 BY. This is 2005 BL. I didn't have the reference. This is Taubenberg. This just came out. I don't know if you've seen this one, Monty. It came out late November. It's a very nice long paper on this new subluminous 05 BL. No, I mean, not new, but new in the literature by Taubenberg and company from the Munich group. So what you see here are the data from this supernovae. These lines are a template that was from 91 BG, which is the prototype of the class, which was the first of these subluminous. Remember, 91 was the exciting year for the brightest and the faintest. But what you might notice is that there's very little data before the peak, okay? And you can see that here as well. There's very little data near the peak. So if you actually want to get the rise time on these, there's not much there. And I just today read this Taubenberg paper because I've been worried about this, and they really addressed it. And actually, I just pulled out of their paper this interesting quote. What makes these direct measurements so demanding, this is obvious to this crowd, is a need for high quality early time, you know, before day minus 10, which to date is not available for any 1991 BG-like supernovae. So we think the rise time, as I'll show you, is 15 to 20 days, but the earliest point is at minus, you know, is it 10 days before peak. Okay? And so this, they play the game for the one supernovae for which there's data on this, which is 1991 BY. So the presumption was that the luminosity just went like time squared. So if you just do the simple calculation of that the radius is growing, right, like V times T, then the radius goes like, sorry, then R, then the luminosity would go like R squared if T effective is constant, which the reason it should be. So they plotted for that reason a square root of luminosity versus time, right? And the data points, you can't see it back there. This is an upper limit. These are upper limits. This is a data point for this one supernovae. And then they basically constrain it to between 14 and 22 days. Okay? I didn't show the plots for all the typical 1As, but the typical 1As, namely, by typical I mean objects that are sitting back in the dominant part of the Phillips relation, those are pretty well constrained between 16, 17, 18 days. Okay? So you might say, well, why does this matter? Right? There's two reasons it matters. The one is what Monsi talked about when she talked about 2007 AX, which is another subluminous event, which is, of course, from the Arnett law, we take the peak luminosity, right, and we demand that be given by the instantaneous heating from the nickel 56. So, but you have to decide when you start your clock. If you start your clock 20 days before then or 12 days before then, you will get a different nickel mass, right? Because the radioactive clock starts ticking at a different time. And therefore, you will get, so if, for example, the subluminous events have a shorter rise time, let's say, let me be extreme and say 14 days, take this limit, instead of 18 days, you're going to get the nickel mass wrong, right, first off. Now, you might say that doesn't matter too much because it's already a low number. It's 0.05. It'll go from 0.05 to 0.04, so what? However, the more important thing is the total mass will be different. So you might remember from when we did some of this analytics that there's this characteristic time in the problem, which goes like the mass times kappa, the velocity of the ejecta times c to the 1/2. Okay. And so if the rise time knows about this, and so if the mass is less, you'll get a shorter rise time. So it's definitely the case that if you really do the modeling and you ask the modelers, how do you get the total mass from the light curve, it has to do with this width, okay, is how that becomes. So if you really had a constraint on the rise time, that would strongly constrain the models and maybe lead to some real evidence, shall we say, that the total mass could be less than, you know, the typical 1.35. All right. So that, for me, is, you know, potentially a reason to go after this. Of course, it's hard, right? Because what would you want to do, right? You'd want to do a one-day cadence, and you'd want to be setting the depth of your cadence down, you know, at the V curve somewhere down here, four magnitudes below the peak, right? So the exercise that has not been done is to take this prediction
as a fiducial, run it out and ask at a one-day cadence what would be your yield from a given survey, right? And I haven't done that yet, but that's something I'm.
Don't the ROTC, the 15 type 1As from ROTC, don't they have a better sampling, like 1 day or something? Better sampled light curve?
So Robert, you have 1 day sampled light curves?
I do. I don't have any sublimits 1As though.
Ah, okay. Monty was being hopeful. Okay, so that's one notional thing. I'm going to come back and talk about this plot in a minute. These are old numbers, which I haven't done a sanity check on. So Justin did this, right, Justin? He's grinning, which means he remembers the plot. So if you just take a depth of V of 21 and assume that the 91 BGs are about 20%, you know, 1 in 5 of the supernovae, which actually I think today you could do this at the factor of 2 level, nobody can prove you wrong, then for the numbers I ran at the time, I haven't tried to update this since it was 100 per year in the 3-day cadence, if there was a 3-day cadence with 800 square degree and that number at 2,500 square degrees. And, you know, this is what really should be done. Now, the interesting thing here, and this is what Justin did for this calculation, is this question I brought up with Monty, which is that when we get down to these levels of absolute magnitudes of -18.5, -17.5 for different seeings, you have to pull this out of the light of the host galaxy. So the calculation that Justin did here was where we populated the universe with L-star galaxies, gate at the number density to match the K-light density that's been measured. So you just have a delta function galaxy distribution. Gave each of those a de Vaucouleurs profile, and then demanded at the seeing limit that the object was as bright as the disk, as the surface brightness. Okay. So the point is, this is a first cut, probably too extreme, at getting rid at asking how much of the core light is excluded from the survey because it's so bright that you can't see the event. Okay? Now remember, for typical type 1As, people don't sweat this too much because their typical 1A is brighter than the galaxy. So as they say, anybody can find it. Right? When you get into these events, and it's even worse for the 0.1As, you have to start worrying about how much of the effective mass you're losing in the host because it's hidden. Right?
So you have the supernovas following the de Vaucouleurs profile.
That's correct. So these are following the de Vaucouleurs profile. And so this is showing if you had typical at -17.5, this is your cutoff of your survey. So here's the rate just in the universe, right? So this is the 91 BG rate out at, so here's a gigaparsec. So we're getting about 10 to the 4. Actually, this number is almost jiving then. So that's 10 to the 4. The number we were saying was, I wrote it down today. Yeah, I wrote 10 to the 5. Good. So 1As, okay, let me give you a few numbers. In a gigaparsec, in a distance at a gigaparsec, there are 10 to the 5 1As per year. Okay? Everybody got that? And I think that number is not debatable. This number you can debate. This number we took to be, this is about 10 to the 4, so it's about 1 in 10, so it's not too far off from the 20%. So these numbers are more or less right. Okay? If you can get to a gigaparsec. So if they're at -17, the rate is, as you can see, is 1,000 per year all sky. Okay. And you know, you have to decide how much of the sky you're going to stare at. So it's not crazy to imagine you're going to get a lot of these in PTF. But this question, I think, is a serious one and something that has to be addressed, which is the loss. So this is showing the decrement. Right? And you should think of this literally as you're losing them in the host light. And we did this in an extreme case, in that we demanded that the surface brightness, that the supernovae match the surface brightness, which of course is really, really bad subtraction. I presume you're doing better subtraction than just the surface brightness itself. You're probably doing, well, you would know. It would be very interesting to take your data and ask how well you can subtract. Is it root n or is it, you know?
It would be root n, right? You can't do better than the square root of the.
We agree with that.
Yeah.
Can't do better than that. And we were saying, we were more severe than that, right? We said you can only subtract of order the brightness, not root n.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I think I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. Let me talk about this, because I think this is a way I'm trying to think through how we can have some expectation for all these weird events. So remember, we've talked about that roughly 10% of white dwarfs, so I'm changing this topic here, 10% of the white dwarfs that are being born have these late healing flashes, right? And they get up to, you know, -8. We think that the merger rate of white dwarfs, that's about 1 in 100 white dwarfs, so 1% of the time, you make some arc core Bohr star and get to -8. And something that I think is not going to work well for PTF is that stars, of course, leave the tip of the red giant branch. You know, they're sitting there and then they're gone, right? They have to go. And of course, those are sitting at -4.5 at the tip of the red giant branch. So that's probably not so interesting. However, they're all of these are more or less scaling to the white dwarf formation rate. So we should just ask, as a function of age of the stellar population, what's the specific, this is not, this, I'm using this label for something else, the specific white dwarf birth rate. So this is number per L sun per year. Okay? So the number I keep telling you is that 10 to the 11 solar luminosities, there's roughly 1 or 2 per year. That's this plot. So here's is for a saltpeter-like IMF, the red points are the ones to stare at. If I have an old stellar population, I'm roughly getting not even 2 per year, 2 white dwarfs per year, right? And it's a little bit less for a young population. Per luminosity, okay? Not per mass, per luminosity. Just so you know, this is taken from a paper on planetary nebula formation, which is how you actually learn these things in distant galaxies. You count up the number of planetary nebulas. You, with confidence, state they have a lifetime, and then you see if the number makes sense. So that's not so good, right? Because you have to know the lifetime of visibility of the planetary nebula. Okay, so what I think would be interesting to do, and just hasn't been done yet, is so Monsi showed this plot of how much mass she has or how much luminosity she has in her sample. You could ask for that sample, what's the specific white dwarf rate of white dwarfs being formed, right? At least you can use that then as your baseline. You can say if 1 in 10 white dwarfs are, give us something like this, then we're going to have an interesting, you know, we're going to have a survey with an interesting depth, right? If you don't, if you're not even getting down to 1 in 10, then, you know, you can't really sample this question. And if you're not getting to the 1 in 100, you can't really sample this question. Okay, so that's, again, an exercise that hasn't been done yet, but I think it's probably worth doing going forward. Again, for these, of course, it's much harder, and that's why I asked again about that light, finding them in the host, right? That's a much harder problem. And so I can go back to this plot, and again, this sort of shows what Monsi was showing in different units. So these are for classical novae, so this is, again, a plot from Justin. We should publish all these sometime. You should publish all these sometime. Distance, here's Virgo. This is the classical novae rate. So this is again, just this is really just mass of the, this is just mass. That's all this is. Here's Virgo. And then again, if you just populate your universe with L-star galaxies, these would be the expectations all sky. Okay? Right? So what you see, of course, is that Virgo, if you just took this number down and put it here, Virgo is most of the mass at that distance, which is again what Monsi was showing, right? That in a volume of 10 megaparsecs, most of the mass, by most I mean, you know, a third or something. Of the mass in that volume is in Virgo. So you stare at Virgo. You don't do an all-sky survey. We did this for, I think this plot was motivated by LSST, I believe, right? Showing what the all-sky rate would be for LSST of classical novae. All right? So this is to a depth of 24. Yeah, this looks right. 30, yeah, roughly. All right? So again, if you have a half arc second seeing, you're going to have 20,000 classical novae per year in the LSST. So, you know, and popping off an LSST. Okay? But again, this is this question of the host light loss due to things just being lost in the host. Okay? And this, again, could definitely be improved. All right. So I'm going to skip point 1As because you've all seen it. But let me give you the number. You've seen all this. I think we have a PTF plot here. So here's another plot that again, Justin did for PTF a while back.
of if we had 0.1As, and in this case had a volume rate that was 5% of the 1A rate. Okay. Again, this is the rate, the total rate of these things popping off. Here's 100 megaparsecs, here's 400 megaparsecs. If their absolute magnitude only gets to minus 15, these are the two numbers, roughly 10 per year out to that distance. Okay. And so here was the number we got, which is that if they get up to minus 17, then it's about 200 per year all sky. And so if they can be found in the 9-day cadence, then it'll be 12 per year for the 0.1As. Okay. So it's going to be just close for the 0.1As with PTF. But again, this is something that we should really get. Now, the last plot I want to show, and then I want to explain it, is this whole question of optimal cadence. Okay? So some people have seen this plot, probably. So let me first show you the plot and then explain the calculation. I'd rather do it the other way, but since this is up, I'll do this, and then I'll turn it off. So there's a question of how you optimize the cadence. And the question is, what are you trying to achieve? If you're trying to achieve maximum discovery rate, okay, that's sort of what this plot is showing. So let me tell you what this is. So this is the cadence. So you give me a telescope, all right? And I will tell you what's going to be the discovery rate as a function of the cadence. So obviously, the longer the cadence, right, the more sky I do. That's the trade-off, right? And I'll walk through that algebra in a minute. So here's a type 1A where I gave a typical luminosity. That's this 1. The 1 is the 1A volume rate, and it rises in 16 days and falls in 16 days. So I had a linear rise and an exponential decay. That's what I did for this calculation. And of course, surprise, surprise, right? The optimal cadence is around 16 days. Now, I defined it here as you had to see it twice in the survey. That's the definition. So, and I have to define what I mean by that, and I'll show you that. But I had to find it twice.
Can you treat images, nothing, something,
maybe? You have the nothing image. So I have to find it twice in the survey. And so the survey depth depends on a 15-day typical luminosity. You should think of it that way. And I'll, right? Imagine a light curve, and I can, okay? A 91BG-like, which I assume to be half as bright, half as frequent, but with a rise of 12 days and a fall of 12 days, is this curve. Okay? 0.1As, which are, let's say, in this case, I took it to be 20% as bright, 7% of the rate, and rise and fall in 5 days are shown here. Okay? So the main point is that most of the surveys that you saw are all cadenced down here at 4, 5, 6 days, where you can see they're in terms of their discovery rate, they're sacrificing, let's say, a factor of 2 or maybe a factor of 3 in the number of 1As they're finding. And of course, they're doing that because they want to get the photometry out of the survey. That's the main goal. They want to not have to do follow-up with a different telescope. They want the follow-up within the survey. So that's the price you pay. Okay?
How does a 12-day cadence find any 0.1As?
It finds very few.
With a 5-day rise and a 5-day fall, aren't you over?
Well,
you have to find it
twice. It's a linear rise and an exponential fall. Yes, you'll find it twice on the exponential, and they're faint, and the volume's thin, and so that's why this dies out, right? Right? That's why all these die out eventually at an infinite cadence, okay, is because they're decaying on this time scale, even the type 1As, right? You might ask, why does this fall? This is falling because they're getting fainter, right? So if you had a 2-month cadence and you look for 1As, you're going to, on average, find them, right, when they're not at their peak. And so you have a smaller volume, but you have a larger angle in the sky. So this is a way to quantify this. Okay?
Sorry, if you see an event twice, how can you be sure what it is?
You tell me what your criterion is. I can do the calculation.
I mean, does it change a lot if you demand you see it 3 or 4 times?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you can do that calculation. I mean, I can do that calculation. Right? You have to decide what your criteria is. And that's why I think this is important to talk about, which is, I think for PTF, there's a question. If, let's say, the number that Monsi showed is 700 type 1As per year at a 5-day cadence, I would ask, why do we need that many type 1As? What's the science goal that needs 700? Maybe it's better to do a 1-day cadence, which is not even on this plot, right? go to here, have many, many fewer of them, but also have a better sampled light curve, right? But also fewer to follow up, because and maybe get a better rise times. I mean, that's the trade space that has to be discussed.
So we do have a 1 day cadence, right? And so about PDF, I didn't put the numbers, but like about 40% of the time, 80% of PDF is transients, 40% of the time is this 5 day experiment, and 40% of the time is the dynamic cadence experiment. So the dynamic cadence experiment can very well be tuned to 1 day. I mean, initially we did faster cadence just to get a sense of the fastest transients, but the third of those experiments would essentially be a 1 day experiment.
Yeah. So what I'm arguing for though is that there might be no reason to do a 5 day cadence. Okay? Huh?
Different person to different.
No, I know. I'm just putting it on the table. It's, you know, why do you need 700 per year, right? Okay, so in the last 10 minutes, let me show you some of the algebra of how you understand some of this. Actually, we can turn this off. Or actually, wait. So before I do that, was there a question on the slides? Sorry. Was there a question on the slides before in the last 10 minutes? Do algebra or everybody's tired? Silence. Huh? Okay, so let me do this brief bit of algebra. Okay, so this is pretty simple, right? This is the theorist's version of defining a survey. All right, so imagine I have some rate, R of something, right? And again, you're going to give me a survey, right? So I'm going to have some exposure time of my snapshots. That's the exposure time of my images, right? And I'm going to have exposure time. I'm going to have a time for my cadence. I don't know can the guys at Caltech see this or not?
I can see the word time.
Are you operating the camera?
We're trying to, but I think we need a different password.
Oh, okay. I'll operate right in the middle then. How's that?
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Got it. So if I'm here, can you see that line?
I can see that, yes.
Okay. Can you see that line? Huh?
Come back?
No
more. Yeah, too much. Yeah, but we can do that easy.
Okay, so R is my rate. T exposure is the exposure time. And T cadence is the cadence. So the solid angle of the survey is, of course, just the cadence time. Again, I'm not worrying about things like, you know, day, night, clouds, moon. Okay? Give me the telescope. All right? So everybody agrees that's the solid angle of the survey. Right? It's the cadence divided by them. That's just what you do. And I'm going to say the survey has some duration, big T. Okay, and so the number of objects I get is just going to be omega survey over 4 pi times t times the rate, right, times the volume, which is 4 pi over 3 d cubed. Okay, so that's the number of things I'm going to find, and I have to define all these things, right? So first, what's the volume? Stay between the lines, try to be a good boy. Right? So there's some minimum flux, right? Which is, I'm going to call this curly bracket L. I'm going to have to define what I mean by that. You should think of that as that's going to be the typical luminosity given your cadence. Okay, that's not working. Okay? And that's then 4 pi d squared.
Is it the minimum or, like, you have a depth?
So this is your depth of your survey, which of course depends on your exposure time, and I have to optimize that, and I'll do that in a minute. This squiggly L is given your, so let me say it very simply. If you have a 1 day cadence and you're looking at type 1As, this L will be like the peak luminosity. Okay? If you have a 1 year cadence, this will be not the peak luminosity. Right? So, and that's what you have to actually calculate offline, not at the blackboard. Okay? But this, you should think this knows about the cadence. Does everybody see that? This is key. So it's probably the only thing I'm going to tell you that's not obvious.
Because it's going to be different you have the 5-day rise, right?
Yep.
You take a mean velocity in the first 3 days of that rise, and the second 3 days it will be very different now.
Yeah, so this, you have to have a light curve. Once you have a light curve and you give me the cadence, I can calculate what this is. Right, which is
for
that
each segment separately.
Exactly. So you should think of it as there's a phase distribution of where your cadence is relative to the explosion time. That's one variable in the problem, right? So you've got a periodic cadence and it has some relative phase depending on relative to the explosion. So this L will vary based on your cadence phase relative to your start time of your event. Okay? And that's actually pretty important. Okay, so then this just defines my D cubed. Right, as this L, this is just algebra, 4 pi F min, you know, the 3/2. Okay? So let's write this last bit out again to get the rate, because that's what I'm interested in right now. Right? So then this just becomes the number per time, right, is T cadence over T exposure, omega of my camera, the rate divided by 3, and then this squiggly L divided by 4 pi F min to the 3/2. Okay? So that's my formula. Now we just have to optimize, ask how I optimize this thing. So you can see there's a few optimizations, which I'm not going to go through in detail. One optimization is there's a TE here for exposure time, and there's an F min, and clearly these relate. Right? So clearly there's an optimization. So the first optimization is to optimize the depth, right? Which is really an optimization of F min and TE. Does everybody see that? Right? And I think any observer can tell me what this should be. Ah, interesting. This tells me whether I actually need to explain this. Do you see the question?
Yeah.
I can expose for 30 seconds, or I can expose for 5 minutes.
So that's all that sky backgrounds.
Right.
See.
If you go add exposures, you'll be getting just square root times benefit.
Well, I don't mean by co-ad. I mean when I take my image for the sky, do I sit there for an hour or do I sit there for a minute? Right.
A minute.
Otherwise, you'll capture the sky. That was great.
So I'm about to prove to you that étendu is not the right variable.
You want to go until you're no longer until you become skylight.
Exactly correct. Okay, so as usual, Tim has the answer. Okay, that's exactly the right answer. There is an optimum. Okay, and it's all about sky and seeing. And I'll save you the algebra. Okay, but you notice that this variable is 1 over TE F min to the 3/2. That's a thing. And indeed, the optimum is that you go until the sky hits you. So if A is the area of the telescope, and FS is your sky. I'm being sloppy with my variables, but it's exactly what Tim said. It's the sky limit. Okay? So this is, you should think of it as the number of photons in your seeing disk, in your your pixel. Okay? So it's all right? So that's the optimum. And so when you write that out, when you put that back in then to the rate, what you get is that's TC omega C R over 3. And then you get this L to the 3/2, the area of the telescope, that's A, divided by 4 pi to the 3/2, F sky to the 1/2. Okay? So the first thing to say is that this thing is proportional to A omega C. That's what you always hear as being in the pissing match that goes on between all surveys. This is what they call étendu. But it ain't the étendu that matters for this. It's the étendu divided by, if you really want to think of it this way, the sky brightness times the seeing squared. That's what this FS is. Okay.
So I've only seen this issue come up in pissing matches between, for example, LSST and SNAP, where sky and seeing is very different in space.
Yeah.
for ground-based observations, sky and sea,
Well,
for at least the future surveys that are actually doing the pissing against each other.
Yeah. No, but I think this was the issue between CFHT Legacy and Essence, is that this thing killed one but not the other. Okay?
I've seen a comparison between Haleakala and Mauna Loa for the same telescope, where the denominator, in fact, is exactly what they used to compare the sites.
Because A Omega was the same.
Because A Omega is the same.
Yeah, right. So I think part of the reason I did this algebra was absolute and complete frustration and dissatisfaction with the answers I was getting about optimal cadences, where they said, well, you know, it's a week. Because, you know, you wake up, you go to bed, it's like a night, a week, a month, or something. I don't know. Okay? And this constant, it's A omega, but it's not, you know, okay. Okay, so this is the first thing, is that When I think we make the mother of all tables, this is the one where actually you can see who's winning and who's losing. Okay, and why. Right? Okay, so now back to the other variable, sorry, which is kind of muddy in my equation. So did I go out of the boundaries for the Caltech? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only the punchline
is out of the boundary, huh?
Only two-thirds of it.
Only two-thirds of it. Okay, you missed the good part. So it's A omega, that you know, divided by the sky times the seeing squared to the one-half. Okay?
In your units.
In my units,
does the sky vary? You know, from night to night, but also from site to site.
No, this is just, I'm not doing that. So this is just at a given site. I mean, that's not in this formulation, right? I mean, this is just you give me a telescope where nothing changes with time, right?
It's something I don't know. How much does the sky brightness change from night to night, from site to site?
Well, night to night, well.
But the moon.
It's the moon, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So this is where you can put the moon in.
Factors of times from new moon to.
Okay.
It's factors of several, many, from site to site.
Okay, so the second optimization is cadence, yes. Right? So the second, so look at this formula. You see there's a T cadence here, right? Okay, and an L squiggly to 3/2. Everybody see that? So after I've optimized for depth, right? I've optimized for the depth of the survey. I've determined my exposure based on the site, right? Then I just have to optimize this guy. So that's, I have to optimize TC L to the 3/2. Okay, so this is where I need a light curve to do this optimization, right? And I need a definition of what you're doing. So again, right, for type 1A, you'd say, well, if I have a 15-day cadence, so remember this L knows about T cadence, right? Does everybody understand that? Right? And so this is then the thing I have to optimize, and that's what I showed you. Okay, what I showed you was those curves, right? For a given light curve shape, what as a function of T cadence, what's this curve look like? And that's what I showed you here, was this guy. Where my definition was, I see it twice. But if you want to see it five times before the rise, then there's a different L squiggle here. Different L bracket. If you want to see it five times before the rise when it's still two magnitudes less than the peak, that's a different L. So you can define what you want here. Or you want to see it once, like the good survey. And you know it's not there, you know, you have some other. That's a different L, right? So again, I think with this you can actually do that with a real light curve shape, right? So I think there's a way to think about it, and there's a way to put in you can put in your month variation right here from the sky, right? Because this is just, you know, you can figure out how much better or worse you are as a function of lunar cycle if you want to get detailed.
What is the third symbol?
Sorry, this R is the rate. This guy? This is just the rate and the volume. Sorry. Right? And this is the area of your telescope, and that's your sky brightness per pixel, you should think of it. Okay, and you can also then show, and I've got the notes here, this is the optimum, but actually it's a pretty if you carry it through for the survey question, it's a pretty shallow, how do you want to say it? It's a pretty it's a broad optimum, okay? So if you ask how much worse do you do if you go off either side, it's not that bad. And I've got that. I've got the algebra, not necessarily the reality, but at least the algebra for how that goes. Okay. So I think for PTF, this is a good exercise to do while it's cheap to do it, right? Which is before you are spending telescope. Okay, so I think we're done.
There's another consideration that you have. You now go to a more complicated scenario.
Okay.
Which is to say, think about this detectable flux,
detectable
luminosity. So you can imagine a strategy, and it's not hard to see why I think about this, where you have one telescope that says, gosh, I think there's something going on in this galaxy.
Right.
And you can then point another one.
Correct.
At the same place.
Correct.
And say, yeah, there is, or no, there ain't.
That's right.
And that allows you to set your threshold lower in the first place.
Right.
And it doesn't change this rate.
That's correct.
Except that it allows you to go deeper with the same resources.
Exactly. So my understanding of PTF is that is, for some targets, that is the idea, is you don't do the follow-up in the survey. So you optimize the survey for discovery, period. Now, for 1As, my claim is you don't want to do that because you're going to get 700 a year, right? For other things, we might want to do that because you're going to get 20 a year that you can actually follow up, right? So I totally agree, and I think that's only when I asked like the CFHT people, why in the world did you reduce your 1A discovery rate by a factor of 4 by doing a short cadence? Oh, because we wanted to do the follow-up in the survey. And so, you know, they paid the price, but it didn't matter. For their science, 500 supernovae was adequate. And so in my mind, that's the question we've got in front of us for PTF, is that for the 1As, you know, you might not need 500, in which case there is no point in doing a 5-day cadence for the 1As. But there might be other science goals where you want to, so for example, there might be a 6-month cadence that's not crazy for something. So for example, for the type 2Ps that last for 100 days, if I did this calculation, right, this number is the same number for 100 days, in which case I could put this T cadence, I'd put this in 100 days. Duh, right? And so for type 2Ps, I know exactly what to do here. This would be like a 100-day cadence would be perfect for discovery, right? And then, you know, you're gaining.
So I have a question. All of this discussion is really just said, what is the optimal way to detect some transient with some light curve twice, right?
What I showed you, the plot I showed you, was for detecting it twice.
Yes.
But I could make anything you want.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, so, I mean, your whole argument seems to be based on maximizing the number of discoveries, right?
Yes.
At some point, you also have to consider that you have to be able to say what these things are.
Agreed.
Right? So let's say that you do have a 0.1A in your survey, and you detect it once, and maybe you detect it, you know, we'll be optimistic and say they peak at minus 17, so you detect it once at minus 16, and then a few days later you have it at minus 15 or something like that.
Right.
That's really not enough information to say absolutely anything about it.
Yeah.
There's lots of other things, lots of 1Cs, type 2s that can do that sort of behavior as well.
Yes.
So you haven't actually discovered a 0.1A.
Understood.
Right.
So I think what I'm hoping is that this is a, you know, I think the way, a nice way to say it is this provides at least a framework for deciding. If you want to discover it just from the photometry alone and differentiate it from something else, then you'd say no, I want to see it 5 times at above some level or whatever you think is adequate, right? And then we'd go back and recalculate the rate for that being the threshold. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's interesting.
So you say I got to see it 5 times before the peak, whatever. If that's the criteria, I'll go do the rate and it's going to be smaller, for sure, right? And like you're saying, that's the realistic differentiation one has to do. And the only question is, do you learn anything there about how is that informing the cadence of the survey? Or is it also unbelievable, you just say, screw it, we're just going to do 5 days, right? Which is, I think, what's happened in the past. So you could also imagine random cadences. I mean, it's never really clear the periodic's the best. And there's whole, books on that. But I see Eli grimacing heavily at random cadence. There's many ways of filling a Fourier space.
I hear logarithmic cadence a lot, where you want each field to have just,
So what are the what does the rise look like for other things?
I've not done a good survey of the literature for that. I don't have a good answer. Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting to know. I think for the type 2Ps, what we saw was not a lot was known. At least I couldn't find much. They all, by the time you see them, they all seem to already be at the plateau, right? Yeah. And they just sort of got there.
The Mansi, I like Shree's plot where you have absolute magnitude and time scale, and then you kind of draw boxes to show what you can do and that no one else can do. So it seemed that for PTF, there was all this, it was a nice big box around.
Oh, that was P60. I didn't put PTF on there because are many different experiments.
So, but it all seemed to be, fairly short timescales. I mean, what's, the question is, has anything been predicted to lie in that box? Or is it all just, we have no idea what might be going
on? So for less than a day, it's... Mm-hmm. It's really like boldly go, like Iran once said this, like boldly go where no man has gone before, kind of thing. Okay, one example of something that varies on minute timescale is this GRB 07 or 610, which was a GRB in our galaxy. This thing, even a day and a half after the detection in gamma rays, varied by 4 magnitudes in 3 minutes. So this has very crazy flares days after, minute timescale flares, a few magnitudes in amplitude at late time. So this is one light curve that I've seen which varies on minute time scales. But what else is there that is transient and not just variable? Like this one is transient. It was not there, then gone. I don't know. There are flare stars, envelope flares that are one-liners, lots of them. There's lots of galactic stuff that we know of. I don't know what extragalactic things are.
Okay.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Thanks.